Greetings and welcome to Fit for Duty. I'm Dr. Larry Earle, your host and president of the National Association of Occupational Health Professionals. Today we'll explore the world of occupational health, unraveling the complexities of OSHA-regulated exams, workers' compensation cases, drug testing, and injury care strategies. We'll also examine prevention strategies, total person health analytics and interventions, discussing innovative approaches to preventing workplace injuries and illnesses, using total person health analytics to identify underlying factors contributing to workplace health issues, and showcasing successful interventions that have improved employee health and well-being. Fit for Duty provides a holistic approach to occupational health, empowering organizations to create healthier, more productive workplaces. Join us as we push the boundaries, break down silos, and bridge theory and practice. Welcome back to Fit for Duty. In part one of our discussion with Dr. Diana Kramer, we began exploring delayed recovery in workers' compensation. Today, we're focusing on the biopsychosocial model, an approach that considers the worker's whole life, not just the physical injury. We'll discuss the surprising role of work in healing, why getting the right diagnosis is crucial, and how mental and social factors can impact recovery. Plus, Dr. Kramer will share how technology can help us personalize treatment and make the entire system work better for everyone. Let's get started. Welcome back to this Fit for Duty episode. This is part two of delayed recovery in workers' comp cases with our special guest, Dr. Diana Kramer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you back. Hey, you know, last time we talked about collectively making this transition from the medical model of workers' compensation injury care to the biopsychosocial model. And you mentioned a few terms that I want you just to give me a quick one-liner, top of mind, about 80-20. What does that mean?
80-20 is the concept that 80% of our workers go back to work, and it's only 20%, it's the outliers essentially, that cause the work and the burden to the system.
Resiliency.
Resiliency is the concept that we all meet adversity every day. We grow from adversity. We remember, the way I like to say this the most is, if we remembered every bad thing that ever happened to us, we probably wouldn't get out of bed. And therefore, we incorporate our past learning experiences into the person we become going forward. And that can lead to a sense of growth or a sense of stagnation.
Wow. Great definition. I don't think I've heard it put quite like that. Wonderful. Return to work is good for you.
If we don't work, we lose a part of our social identity. When you're at a party, one of the first things that happens is, what do? When we don't work, our medical comorbidities go up, our income goes down, our quality of life goes down, and we die earlier. So as we are advocating for our patients, one of the things we need to do is consider that part of our medical treatment is returning that person back to work. It is good for them.
That's one of the vital signs for workers' compensation. Are you working? Right?
Yes, exactly.
Biopsychosocial model does not take more time, but different time.
Yes, you and I as treating physicians are in the records. We are in the records. We're looking at past medical history. We're looking at allergies. There are other clues in those records. This does not require more time reviewing the records. It requires different time and different focus. What are the comorbidities? What's the educational level? What are are there multiple other contested claims? Is there a history of this person who's had prior injuries that has delayed recovery? Takes a year or 2 years to recover from something that would typically not take that long. those clues are in that medical record, and we're in that medical record anyways. This is a matter to some extent of enlarging our scope, our horizon, our radar.
Seek the correct diagnosis. That doesn't sound like it should be difficult.
It doesn't, but if you think of the science there, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the diagnoses that you and I make every day are incorrect or marginally correct. Mm. And I think as part of our medical honesty, we need to keep considering what the diagnosis is. And we need to not accept a diagnosis being sent to us. So I think that critical thinking is part of who we need to be. And the reason I think this is important is that if we don't make the correct diagnosis, it's not clear to me how we're going to treat that person. Part of the diagnosis has to do with the mechanism of injury and the causation around that event. So if we are ascribing something to an injury, for example, that may be part of normal aging, then we may be creating a conflict. So last time we spoke, I gave the example of bilateral imaging findings. If we have a worker who comes in with repetitive overhead work, and we get an MRI on one shoulder, and there's a rotator cuff tear, and the person's 50, I think we need to consider that the other shoulder probably looks the same. The other knee probably looks the same. That may change our treatment paradigms. So I think part of the diagnosis has to do, you may make the correct diagnosis, but you may not necessarily make the correct causal inference. And if you treat a degenerative rotator cuff as just an injury, you may be doing your patient a disservice.
And I think that handles the next item, context of causation analysis. So let's move on. Listening to our patient does not equal relying on self-report.
One of the things, and we talked about this last time, is that it is healthy for us to forget our past infirmities. When a person comes in as our patient and tells us something, it's important for us to understand that past context, that it's healthy to forget. And therefore, what the person says to us needs to be accepted, may not need to be accepted at face value, and may be worthwhile putting within the context of causal inference and perceived injustice and other biopsychosocial models.
And I like this last one, balance fear of missing something with the fear of overtreating. I love this one.
It is easy in a patient, in physician interaction, to want to do the right thing. That is intrinsic to who we are as physicians. What if the right thing is not getting another test? What if the right thing is not adhering to the biomedical model where all pain and suffering is ascribed to a medical model, and instead we expand our thinking to the biopsychosocial model? So rather than potentially in the absence of red flags or even yellow flags, we redirect. I'm not going to say push back, because when you've got a patient who's looking at you saying, why aren't you doing that MRI? Why aren't you doing another MRI? I think the question needs to be maybe to even preempt the request to go on to more testing and go to more functional outcome. And a part of that has to be the concept of accepting that the goal may not be cure of pain, but the focus needs to be on function. And it doesn't mean we ignore the pain, But what we need to do is get out of the biomedical model where we're going to fix it, get into the biopsychosocial model of how we're going to contain, modify, and grow the person into a new sense of self-accomplishment and agency.
So a surgeon is telling us not to look for things that we can fix surgically.
Yes.
Kind of.
The only thing worse than a person who has low back pain is a person who's had low back surgery and has low back pain.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, so that recaps our previous discussion. Thank you for those insights. Now we're going to move into interventions, proactive interventions. So tell us, what are some early intervention strategies that you recommend for preventing delayed recovery and promoting timely recovery in work-related injury cases?
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad you asked. Let's go back to the 80-20 model. We are looking at that 20%, and I think it's important to realize we're not going to capture that entire 20%. But there are patients who are going to walk into our office that are risk for delayed recovery. And maybe it's 2%, maybe it's 5% of the people that we see. I think one of the ways to have success in accepting and in achieving these goals is to start little and grow. So the first thing we want to do is we want to embrace the biopsychosocial model.
Yeah.
We think in the biopsychosocial model. We just don't realize it. When a person walks into our office and they're depressed, we are automatically in the biopsychosocial model. And I think we just need to embrace that the disease we're looking at is within a person. And that is helpful to us in terms of what we started out to do, which was to treat people, help people. And it's going to bring to our day a sense of relief and a sense of, I like to think that this decreases burnout, because now we're thinking about things differently. And in the middle of a crazy busy day, instead of just walking in and looking at the person who's back in our office who hasn't gotten better, maybe it's as simple as, I sent you for physical therapy. Show me your exercises. Show me two or three of your exercises. And if I can do my IYTs, then, and it takes 30 seconds, then I know that person is compliant with therapy. If the person says, well, I stretch, are they compliant with my therapy? That takes essentially no more time. It's just a reconstruct of the biomedical model to the biopsychosocial. So first of all, it is embracing the biopsychosocial model, which is intrinsically supportive and helps our identity as physicians. The second is to learn. We need to learn this entire field of medicine that we weren't taught in medical school, and that is, how do you learn about the biopsychosocial model? How do you learn about causation? How do you incorporate those into your practice? Who's going to teach you? Who's going to mentor you? And I think the third part of this, as clinicians, the first things we can do as clinicians today or tomorrow is accept the concept of free will, that there are patients where we're going to be able to intervene, and there are patients where we're not. And we don't need to accept the world. We understand already that some of our patients are going to have failed recovery or delayed recovery. And what I'm recommending is we recognize those people who are at risk, but still their course can be modified. That's where we're going to succeed. And as we succeed, we'll be rewarded. And as we're rewarded, we'll grow.
Kind of leads into the second question that we had. How can healthcare providers effectively assess and address social aspects that impact recovery? You mentioned we don't really get trained to do this. So how do we look at these workplace dynamics and support systems, and what's the approach?
Yes, I agree. So we've already talked about the big ones. Recognize the worker at risk for delay in recovery. Integrate the psychosocial context at the beginning of our treatment. For example, if somebody has low back pain and they come in and they're not sleeping, we need to resist the concept that, well, you're not sleeping is not part of your claim. It's part of your general medical, right. And therefore I'm not going to treat it. It can be as simple as you're not sleeping. Here, we need you to do some sleep hygiene. You need to turn off your TV. You need to have your screens out of your room. And I'm going to give you an extra dose of gabapentin at night because gabapentin makes you drowsy. Great. Let's use it at night. So instead of taking 300 at night, you're going to take 600 or 900. It may be something as simple as that, essentially very little more time. Or less time because you're not dealing with the negative and you're listening to the person and you're creating a dynamic of shared interaction and shared decision-making.
Great.
The other things getting back to that accurate diagnosis, early appropriate testing, and then feeling confident in your diagnosis doesn't mean arrogant, means confident. Then as you're dealing with that person regularly, you can watch for escalation of symptoms, screen for risk factors. What are the risk factors for delayed recovery? Older age, lower education, going back to a high intensity job, high physical activity. Those are red flags. So if we start to see that expansion or escalation of symptoms, and now it's not only the low back, but it's the shoulder, or it's the one arm, and now it's the other arm. Those are red flags for delayed recovery. They can be red flags for medical care, but for medical conditions. But if we're thinking in the biopsychosocial model, we can decrease unnecessary testing potentially by focusing on whether or not that escalation of symptoms is consistent with the diagnosis. Maybe the diagnosis has to change, or maybe it's simply escalation, and it's a risk factor.
Yeah, very good.
The next thing I would recommend, and these are just proactive, is this whole concept of avoidance. We talked about rest, and now we need to talk about mice. Motion, and maybe motivation, and we need to address those. We need to set expectations. I need you moving. Yes, it hurts. It's safe. We've checked. You are not going to hurt yourself by moving. Yes, it'll hurt at first. Physical therapy hurts at first. And then set expectations about return to work. And I'm going to talk in a minute about risk, capacity, and tolerance and what that means in terms of our conversations with our patients.
Yeah, let's move into that. The physician's role in addressing social aspects that impact recovery.
Let's talk first about return to work, risk, capacity, and tolerance. Now, me talking about risk, capacity, and tolerance to a group of occupational medicine physicians may be bringing coals to Newcastle. But what we do as physicians is you and I speak in terms of risk and capacity. And our patients are talking to us about tolerance because they don't know what the medical risks are of them doing a task. They don't know about their capacity. So what our patient is talking to us about is, I can't do this, or I'm afraid, or I can't go back to work. Well, why not? Okay. As a physician, we're talking about risk. Is it safe for you to go back to material handling? That is risk. If you have epilepsy, can I approve you for a commercial driver's license? No. Okay. That is an absolute restriction. As opposed to limitations, capacity is the concept that you're injured, Larry. You have been inactive. Your capacity may be diminished from your typical work activities. How am I going to set limitations and get you back into the workplace as we get you better? And the patient's talking in terms of tolerance. I hurt, I can't do that job. Well, getting back to the concept of we're not going to cure your pain, we're going to reduce your pain, and we're going to focus on function. We end up in the clinical setting in a negotiating stance with our patients as to trying to get them from a tolerance model to a capacity model.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think a lot of frontline providers seeing the patients for the first time really struggle with that concept between risk and capacity. They often may not have a full appreciation of what the capacity is to get back to a modified or transitional duty role.
Yes. And how many times have you heard your patients say, they don't want me back at work till I'm 100%. So not only are we doing this capacity evaluation in our office, we're also doing it within a different set of psychosocial constructs, which is the workplace.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think just keying off of your thought there, that oftentimes patients will tell us that, but it's from within themselves. If you talk to the supervisor or the plant manager and you say, hey, we've got these modified duties in mind for this individual. Oh, yeah, we can do that. The patient doesn't often know that that's even available. So maybe that gets into my next question, you know, collaborating with the workplace to make sure that we can address these issues.
Bingo. There's only so much you and I can do in the office. And at some point, this is a systems issue, and it's a huge systems issue. And as you know, anybody who does workers' comp understands there's a massive bureaucracy, administrative burden to the entire system. But if we keep in mind that returning the worker to work is in everybody's best interest. It's in the worker's best interest. It's in the company's best interest, the employer's best interest. It's in the insurance company's best interest. When we get workers back to work, it costs the system less, it's better for the worker, and it improves productivity. So it's no longer a drain. Now we need help in this. So what we need are worker activation programs, whether it's stay at work, return to work. We need case management systems to help us identify when we've identified these people who are at risk for delayed recovery. How do we activate someone, a case manager, to help us interact with the employer? This caseworker does not necessarily need to be a medical person. It's more important that the person have communication skills, skills with conflict resolution, and a knowledge of job accommodation. This whole concept of, and also avoiding isolation, maintaining an integration as simple as within the workplace during early phases of injury, keeping that person as simple as keeping that person in context with the cohorts that they like, potentially keeping them involved, maybe getting them in to some minimal activity, having someone from the workplace call them, and even as simple as, how are you doing? What can we do to help? Yeah. Those minimal interactions can make a huge difference.
Yeah, very good. How can we improve the accuracy and effectiveness of risk assessments to better predict and proactively address potential challenges in individual cases?
So we know that we are going to have people with delayed and failed recovery. It is intrinsic to the system. It has a known incidence, it can be expected and anticipated. We need models of risk stratification. And this has to do not necessarily, for an individual, we need a system of identifying risks within that person. So we need if somebody's at moderate to high risk of delayed recovery, and there's an entire system for doing that. I'll talk about that next. We need to intervene early, and it's cost effective. We need stepped care models for this person. We need health. It can be as simple early on, health education, health cognitions, self-efficacy, and shared decision-making. Those are, you know, entry-level interventions. Larger ones, destigmatizing such things as cognitive and behavioral treatments, which is a huge burden and needs to be done in a stepwise fashion because, for example, the insurance company is not going to want to accept a lifelong psychiatric issue. But let's start short of psychiatric issues. Let's talk about CBT for pain avoidance, for example. That's not a psychiatric issue. That's a known complication of having pain. And CBT does work for pain and movement. Cymbalta can help with pain. Those are simple interventions, don't necessarily mean that the person has a psychiatric issue. So those would be potentially mid-level psychiatric or mid-level interventions based on the biopsychosocial model, but not based on a biomedical model of psychiatric change.
Yeah, some good individual strategies. And then you talked about things that are wrong with the system, right? What systems are contributing to delayed recovery?
So personally, let's start with the medical. Let's start with me in my office. And we've all seen this where we take over a colleague or we see if you're doing medical legal evaluations or you're doing independent medical evaluations. And you see a person, you make a set of recommendations. This person can do X, Y, and Z. And the treating doctor comes back and says, no, they can't. You know, I said that they X, Y, Z. If they can't do X, Y, Z. That concept of misguided advocogenicity, where we say a person can't go back to some task and possibly they can, or possibly there's a modified work. The concept of changing our own fixed ideas of what a person can do, because sometimes being an advocate for a patient, we can take it too far. The second issue is medicalizing some of these psychosocial issues. It's tempting. And the third is excessive workup or excessive treatment. We've all seen people have been to 30 physical therapy, 50 physical therapy. I don't want to beat up on chiropractors. Have had 50 sessions of visual therapy or balance therapy or acupuncture. How do we realize when more is just more?
Yeah, talk about some of the administrative issues that take away from efficiency.
All right, so filling out paperwork, right? So trying to get that care pre-approved. Not only doing the paperwork for pre-approval, but then once we've put in that request, knowing if that ever got seen, accepted, worked on, and if the person was referred for treatment. Now, if you look at systems of best practices, there are timelines. For it's amazing. If you look at official disability guidelines or if you look at Washington State medical treatment guidelines, it'll say for low back pain, first week, second week, fourth week, sixth week. And when was the last time you saw a person four times in the first 6 weeks after, you know, low back injury? The delay is accepted at this point. It's an administrative issue. And really, if we do this right, it can fit into our clinic because now we see people for 10, 15 minutes. We don't have 20, 30 minutes. So fine, I spend 10 minutes with you now. I'm going to see you in 2 weeks. I'm going to see you in a week. In 2 weeks, we're going to do this. And if I see you back in 2 weeks and you're not in physical therapy yet, that's a flag. We need to have efficient denials. We don't have a system, an administrative system for recognizing the at-risk worker. Those are all administrative hurdles that I think insurance companies and employers are interested in looking at. We just don't have the system to do it.
few more minutes left. How can technology help? Is AI helpful here?
So yes, big data is huge. And I've been to some of the workers' comp, national comp meetings. Large language models, big data, AI, stratifying risk within medical context is available. It is up and coming. Early risk stratification, early case management, integrating another, grabbing systems that can integrate treatment recommendations or best practices or guidelines with pre-authorization, help us as clinicians know when and when not we are meeting the pre-authorization guidelines, having a big, you haven't done this, you're going to get denied. Okay, go back, check that box. Those systems can be integrated at a technological basis.
Great. Thanks for that. Hey, from your perspective then, what changes or improvements can be made in the workers' compensation system to better address delayed recovery, unnecessary disability, and high-risk payouts? Wrap it up for us.
Okay. Positive issues. Big data is going to help. Big data, the insurance companies are motivated, as I said, to improve, to work on that 20%. The 20% of people that cost the most money and resources, our time. We, as clinicians, need to embrace evidence-based medicine, incorporate treatment guidelines, and there are many. There's the MD guidelines, there's the California MTOS, there's the official disability guidelines, there's state guidelines. There are a number of guidelines that can be incorporated into best practices. What we as physicians can do is rely on that evidence-based medicine and treatment guidelines. And the guidelines are not rules. And there's times when we need to advocate for our patients and we need to use to those rules to our advantage. This person has had an improvement in their function after 6 physical therapy visits, but 6 is a recommendation. But if someone's improving and has objective interest, objective evidence progress, of improving, then the guidelines say go to 18. We can use those guidelines to advocate for treatment. We need cost-effective interventions that include the biopsychosocial model, and we need a system to help us. We are not going to get this done in the office. In my pipe dream is that somehow these two isolated systems, the workers' compensation system and the private insurance system, work together to create a model of wellness that we can use to help our injured workers get back to work.
And I think we'll leave it on that pipe dream note. I think that's a great place to keep our collective thoughts. Again, what's good? What's the right thing to do? What's the good thing to do for our patients? And turns out for society, right? Corporate goals notwithstanding, usually what's good for a recovered patient is good for the company. So it shouldn't be mutually exclusive, right?
Excellent. Yes, yeah. I agree.
So thank you very much.
I think you summed it up really well.
Absolutely. So I want to thank you, Dr. Diana Kramer, for joining us for part 2 of our discussion on delayed recovery. If you didn't get a chance to check out part 1, please do. Lots of concepts and definitions there if you're not familiar with some of the concepts that have been discussed today. So we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining Fit for Duty. Thanks, Dr. Diana Kramer.
And that wraps up another episode of Fit for Duty. Thanks for joining me today, everyone. I hope you found this conversation as engaging and informative as I did. As always, building healthier, happier workplaces starts with knowledge and collaboration. So if you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to Fit for Duty wherever you listen to podcasts. That way you'll never miss a beat when it comes to the latest trends, best practices, and inspiring stories in occupational health. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and keep elevating workplace excellence.